sign.
Yeah.
Be able to direct you somewhere at least, even if they don't have that.
You would think that, yeah, like Boston Public Library or Library of Congress or something. Oh, well, that's bad. Okay, how are we doing? Well, happy. Okay, we should get back to, just briefly, we should get back to the Blessed Damozel. But I thought I would just say, since the book doesn't, that the Matthew Arnold poem, The Scholar Gypsy, page 305, it's got all the virtues and all the vices of Matthew Arnold, and we're not going to spend much time on Arnold. But remember who Eustace is in Amour du Voyage?
Matthew Arnold.
Yeah, so the shepherd in The Scholar Gypsy is Cloth. So that's who this is addressed to. Go, for they call you shepherd from the hill. Go, shepherd, and untie the wattled coats, etc. So this is Arnold's, Arnold, the other character whom the speaker is addressing is Cloth, just as Arnold is addressed in Amour du Voyage by Claude. Okay, let's go back to... I think what we should do is just go to the end, or near the end, of The Blessed Damozel, because it's a longish poem, and we do have to get to Christina Rossetti. So here again, he's imagining the Blessed Damozel in heaven. And remember, she is dead in the same way as Annabel Lee or the lost Lenore are dead in Poe. This is his idea of writing the counter poem to those poems from the point of view of someone in heaven. And basically, the thing about the Blessed Damozel is that she won't go up to the highest of heavens with all the other dead women, because she is so in love with the speaker, or at least that's what he's imagining. So it's a poem of loss. It's not probably a true poem of loss. That is, this is Rossetti as a very young man imagining such a poem. But what he, I guess, let's start at the bottom of 271. So, I thought we'd brush through it, but just let's just touch down on a couple of things. So on page 270, we get a parentheses, and the parentheses in this poem are really neat. So on page 270, top verse on 270, top stanza, we get a parentheses. It's for the Blessed Damozel, it is... seems like she's only been in heaven for scarcely a day. But albeit to them she left, her day had counted as 10 years. So for her, she's been, it feels like she's died that very day. But in human time, it's been 10 years. And then parentheses. To one, it is 10 years of years. So who is that one? The speaker himself, yeah. So it's been 10 years by the calendar. It has been experienced by the Blessed Damozel as a single day, because heaven is like that. And to the speaker who has lost her and who loves her, it feels like a century. To one, it is 10 years of years. Yet now and in this place, surely she leaned o'er me. Her hair fell all about my face. Nothing. the autumn full of leaves, the whole year sets apace. So those three dots, her hair fell all about my face, and then, no, it's wrong, nothing. She's gone. The whole year. These were just the autumn fall of leaves. That's what he was feeling on his face. The whole year sets apace. Another parenthesis at the top of the next page. Ah, sweet, even now in that bird song, the song that he heard in the previous stanza, strove not her accents there fain to be hearkened. Paraphrase that. Even now in that bird song, strove not her accents there fain to be hearkened.
Uh-huh. You can barely make it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the maybe's important.
Yeah.
That is, didn't I hear her voice striving to be heard? So everyone knows what the use of the word fain is? Like, I would fain have you come with me. What does that mean?
I'd be happy to.
It's not I would be happy to, not as in that would be okay with me. Not that sense of I'd be happy to, but if you would fain do something, what does that idiom mean? It's in Shakespeare all the time. I would fain know that. Okay, it's an idiom meaning I would really like that to happen. It is something that I strongly desire. So it's an expression of desire and an expression of desire that might be met but could very well not be. Interestingly enough, Raymond Chandler will have Marlowe use it sometimes, but Chandler was born in England. He may not have realized it wasn't quite an Americanism. Didn't her accents strive to be heard or to be paid attention to in that bird song? So again, the context is she's dead. He hears a bird singing. Imagines that it's her voice trying to make itself heard. Ah, sweet, even now in that bird song, strove not her accents there fain to be hearkened. When those bells possessed the midday air, strove not her steps to reach my side down all the echoing stair. How would you unpack that slightly odd metaphor? Not just rhyming words, but meanings. Yeah, Arena.
Was it that this, like, her voice isn't trying to catch up with the speaker?
Is not trying to?
Yes.
Go on.
Like, it's staying at a distance? Or that, like, it's like, emphasizing the fact that it might be her voice singing, but there's still, like, a... great distance or, like, divide between them?
Oh, yeah,
It's not trying to, like, when it says, like, stroke not her steps to reach my side, like, if I'm assuming that's her voice is not trying to, like, I don't know, catch up and, like, interact with the speaker again.
Why do you say not, though? I mean, what does strove mean?
Like, if you're trying to do something?
Yeah, so didn't she try, right? Notice it's a question. So that's what's crucial.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, yeah, that
so
makes all the difference.
So if she didn't try to catch up with? I'm confused.
Okay.
It's like when you phrase a question like, oh, didn't you try to do that?
Or, yeah.
Yeah, it's implying that, no, she did.
Yeah.
But yeah. It's weird when it's like in so many different lines.
Yeah. No, it's very impacted, and it's partly line endings and rhymes and the grammar is somewhat impacted. So it's worth unpacking the rhetorical questions here. So he hears a bird, and he wonders, didn't her voice want to be heard in the voice of the bird? In the bird that I just heard, wasn't that her trying to be heard in the bird's song? Wasn't that her trying to be heard? So she's gone. For him, it's been like a century, 10 years of years. And still, there are things that remind him of her. And what the narrator is imagining, so we can't quite call him Rossetti because this isn't a poem of true mourning. But he's, you know, it is within a literary context, as I say, where he's just imagining flipping the script. but what he is imagining is that this person who was meant as much, to whom he meant as much as she meant to him, that's what he's imagining. So you don't have to say, what a noob Rossetti is, how can he possibly know what she really felt about him? That's not, it's not a real person, so that's not the point. The point is that he has a speaker who has lost someone with whom he has had an ideal relationship. They have loved each other completely. So that's a given. Generally, it wouldn't be. Generally, when you read poems of description of another person, of an erotic object, you have to have some suspicion of whether the speaker is getting right what the relationship is. And in general, you should. That's part of the psychology that lots of poetry is about. It's a psychology, you know, there'll be a kind of self-deception in the idea of what you think the other person thinks of you and so forth. Rossetti is just taking that as read. That's just not an issue. Yes, the speaker of this poem is self-deceptive, but the self-deception, because it's about someone who's dead, it doesn't matter because we're not talking about a real person and what she really felt about him and what she would really feel about him if her spirit were in heaven. That's just not the game that he's playing. The game that he's playing is, here is a person, and we loved each other completely, and what the speaker is going to do is try to imagine what she would be feeling in heaven if she were there. And he can't have any communication with her in heaven if she's there, but he can, in his memory, imagine her as the person that he was totally in love with and who was totally in love with him. So that's just that's postulated in the poem. Not something that you have to see the poem as raising questions about. It does raise questions, but it's raising questions at a different place. So here the question is, am I imagining on no evidence at all what she's doing in heaven? Or is there some slight communication that she's making with me because her love for me and my love for her are so intense that even though she's dead, we can still communicate? And the communication is very faint, but it's there. So again, I know I keep saying this, and it's a weird thing to remind you of, but don't be suspicious of that, of the idea that they could love each other that much. Don't be skeptical there's plenty of skepticism in the poem, but that's you get nowhere with the poem if that's where what your skepticism is about. And you should be getting somewhere in the poem. So you should always be skeptical, but in this case, that's not the right place to apply your skepticism. So I hope that makes sense. So birdsong, and he thinks maybe it's her accent singing to him. Then bells possess the midday air. What does that mean?
Church bells sing to
him. Yeah, and they're ringing really loudly, and you're getting that sense of that you get when lots of bells are ringing, that they're separate bells and that the gongs are separate, and there's a kind of discreteness, overlapping discreteness in the sound of bells. And does anyone know Poe's poem, The Bells? Okay.
The bell. I couldn't remember the exact thing, but I remember the repetition.
Yeah, it's the bells, the chiming and the whatever of the bells. What a world of hope deceived their melody foretells as they jingle, jingle, jingle in the icy air of noon. And it ends with the with a famous line, the tintinnabulation of the bells. So it's just Poe describing bells just gonging and gonging and gonging, and what you're getting is this iteration. So it's that iterative sound of bells that Poe is imitating in the repetitions and rhymes of his poems. And that Rossetti is just assuming that that iterative sound is our experience of bells. When there are a lot of bells gonging, like at the end of Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came, the names of all the lost adventurers as peers ring in his ears like bells, that there's a kind of synesthetic. Do people know what that means, synesthetic? What's it mean? Or, sorry.
Synesthesia is when you can, like, see sounds.
Yeah. Yeah, so for some people, for example, notes have colors. Low notes might be dark, high notes might be brighter. Vowel sounds have colors. So synesthesia is when you have a sensory impression that is from a different sense from the thing that's perceiving the whatever it is that you're sensing. So it's perception side by side. It's as though you're having a visual perception of a sound, or you might have an auditory perception of a sight. And very few people have no synesthesia, and very few people are tormented by it, but some people have no synesthesia, and some people really are tormented by it. But there's a spectrum of synesthesia. So the synesthetic feeling here is the bells possess the midday air. How do they do that? What does it mean for bells to possess the midday air? So what does the metaphor mean, first of all? When are the bells ringing?
Noon.
Good. Okay. And possessing the midday air in what sense? Yeah, you can't get away from the sound of the bells. They're just gonging everywhere. They're deafening. But when you say that they possess the midday air, it's almost as though if you were doing a comic book or graphic novel of the bells and of the experience of how they possess the midday air, you know, you could imagine that the person who's being deafened by the bells would look up and see bells floating in the air everywhere. So if you can imagine that visual, it wouldn't be literally what's going on. What's going on is the bells are in their tower and it's the sound waves. But what you would see are the bells everywhere. And what you hear when you hear bells is solidity. You hear the metal of the bells. There's no more metallic sound than the sound of bells gonging. It's not like flutes possessing the midday air. So as soon as you get that sense of their solidity, and a sense of their ubiquitousness. They're everywhere in the midday air. Then he can turn that into an idea that the bells are like stairs. They're solid. They're everywhere. They're overlapping the way bell sounds are. So the synesthetic idea that they can be like stairs starts making a kind of metaphorical sense. So then, when those bells possess the midday air, strove not her steps to reach my side down all the echoing stair. So if you have that visual of bells everywhere visually, then they could also turn into what she's hopping down from the bar of heaven to him, to his ears. Right. Oh, okay. And could you?
Yeah.
I think it would be a cool thing to draw. And remember, he is as great a painter as a poet. Then a little further, he's imagining what she would say. So if you go to line 91, here she's imagining him in heaven. and she says, and I myself will teach to him, I myself lying slow, the songs I sing here, which his voice shall pause in, hushed and slow, and find some knowledge at each pause or some new thing to know. So she's imagining what things are going to be like when he dies and is in heaven. And what she has said at line 79 is, we too will stand beside that shrine, occult, withheld, untrod, whose lamps are stirred continually with prayer sent up to God, and see our old prayers granted melt each like a little cloud. So that's what's going to happen. And then parentheses. Alas, we too, thou sayest, yea, one wast thou with me, that once of old. So, you and I were once one. One wast thou with me, that once of old. But shall God lift to endless unity the soul whose likeness with thy soul was but its love for thee? So, which soul is he wondering whether God will save? His own. So, we too, we were one, but the only similarity or the only place in which I was just like you was that I loved you in the same way that you loved me. The one thing that really I'm confident of is the love I had for you. We were once one, but now you're dead. You're in heaven, but I don't know that I deserve to go to heaven or that God will bring me there. So there is an anxious parenthesis again. She goes on and talks about what will happen in heaven. And so let's go to, let's say, line 127. There will I ask of Christ the Lord, thus much for him and me, only to live as once on earth with love, only to be as then a while, forever now, together I and he. So we'll ask Christ that they can be together forever the way they were once together for a while, only to live as once on earth with love, only to be as then a while, as we were a while, forever now together, I and he. So, end of that story. She gazed and listened, and then said, less sad of speech than mild, all this is when he comes. She ceased. The light thrilled towards her, filled with angels in strong level flight. Her eyes prayed, and she smiled. And then parentheses. I saw her smile. Close paren. But soon their path was vague in distant spheres. That is the path of the angels. And then she cast her arms along the golden barriers and laid her face between her hands and wept. I heard her tears. So they're all shooting up to heaven, and she's there, but she's weeping. And then he says in parentheses, I heard her tears. And it's at that point in those parentheses, remember the parentheses are the moments of skepticism. The parentheses are, I don't know if I think this is really happening, but I want to see her smile. I once saw her smile, is one way that you can put this. And then I heard her tears. She laid her face between her hands and wept. I heard her tears. Why would he say, I heard her tears, rather than say, I saw her tears, or I felt her tears? Why I heard her tears?
Because having a vision is not the same as having, like, an auditory delusion, I guess.
Okay.
Or I feel like the synesthesia, like, experience can imply more thorough union between the two, like a more, you know, a connection at a higher level.
Okay.
It's no longer perceived through your senses, but it's like everything's connected.
Okay, yeah. Nice.
That's
good.
That's a much better way of putting it. I was going to say the cynicism. Yeah. I think delusion is a terrible connotation, but kind of the same as a vision, you know?
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
Laid her face between her hands and wept. I heard her tears. There is not a standard trope, but not a completely unusual trope, where people are surprised to hear themselves crying. And it may well be that because the parenthesis is what happens on Earth, was that her voice striving to make itself heard in the song of the bird? were those her steps striving to walk down the sound of the bells? That the tears that he's hearing are his own. That this is, he's got to do all the work of the love between both of them because she's dead. And so this poem is doing that work partly by imagining her missing him the way he misses her. But he has to do all the work because he has no contact with her. And so what he does is he imagines her sorrow at having no contact with him. And the non-contact between the two of them is what they have in common. That, in a way, is the psychology of the poem. You're in heaven missing me and can't make contact with me. I'm on earth missing you and can't make contact with you. So we're like each other that way. And I can feel intensely what you're feeling in heaven, because we have the same feeling, because I'm feeling the same way about you on earth. So the parentheses, in a way, are giving you a sense of that non-contact. This is actually all happening to me. What I'm describing is happening to you. It's in the parentheses where we don't have contact. But then in this very last parentheses, he's actually asserting that they do, I heard her tears. I saw her smile. But they're also, I mean, just think about the tone of this. It's really subtle and worth attending to the subtlety. Her eyes prayed and she smiled. And then I saw her smile. That is kind of a concession that how could he know this? He's giving a reason that he can say why he said what he's just said. But the very fact that he has to give a reason, I saw her smile, is a concession that he does have to give a reason, that there's a real question, how can you possibly know this? And the answer has to be something like, he didn't literally see her smile. So what did he see? What does the parentheses really mean? Sorry, I thought you were going to say. What if you made saw a genuine past tense? So, obviously, the whole poem's in the past tense. We too, she said, will seek the groves where the Lady Mary is. But it's in the past tense in which you report a narrative. So there is something called a narrative past tense, which is why some narratives can be done in the present tense, like in contemporary fiction, where you get lots of narratives in the present tense. Because even though the narrative's in the past tense, for the reader, it's happening at the moment that it's reported. So if you say something like, and then I pulled out my gun, but he knocked it away and kicked me in the face, but luckily I found the key and blah, blah, blah. You know, you're reading something exciting and that's how it's described. And even though it's in the past tense, narratively it's occurring for you as the reader at the moment that you're reading it. So just think of any page-turning fiction that you've read, but that's in the past tense, like Stephen King, who writes in the past tense, usually, not always, but usually. So it's like Stephen King has this concept of the gotta, which is, honey, come to bed, it's late and you have to get up early tomorrow. I will, but I gotta find out, does she live? And so it's another 20 minutes of reading. And that's why you sometimes get told when people grade your English papers that you should be describing what happens in a play or a movie or a story or a poem in the present tense, even if it's a past tense work. So if you say something like, Eustace writes to Claude, explaining something that Claude didn't know about the interference of Georgina. And in the poem, it's in the past tense, but as you're describing it in your paper, you put it in the present tense, and when you don't, you're told you have to, you ought to. That's proper. And the reason it's proper is because a fictional narrative, unlike a historical narrative, the events only happen at the moment that you read them. So historical narrative, yes, it was 203 years ago that Maine became a state, which eventually led to the Civil War. So you don't say, yes, and Maine becomes a state. It became a state 223 years ago, yeah.
What about with, Claude and Eustace, because they were historically accurate events that actually happened? So if we're referencing the day that the Pope did this in that poem,
yeah,
you still write.
You would do it in the past tense, but you would say something like, when Claude sees someone murdered in the fight on the piazza, and you don't say when Claude saw it, you say when he sees it. So is that intuitive for you after lots of English classes or literature classes?
Yeah, I barely notice it, but I've never thought about it.
Okay, so that's a thing that you will be told if you start describing what happens in a novel or a poem in the past tense. That's a standard correction for someone who's grading you. Oh, it's her voice. Yeah, those are crows, not ravens. Yes.
Yesterday, was it Monday?
Monday
they were really loud.
Yeah,
Monday.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
We are the school children running away from school.
Yes. So, I don't know, you know, so when they go to the woods, Hansel drops stones in order to be able to find his way back. But the second time they go to the woods, he doesn't have time to gather stones, so he drops breadcrumbs. But the crows come and eat the breadcrumbs. So you wouldn't, if you were analyzing Hansel and Gretel, you wouldn't say, on their way to the woods, Hansel dropped stones. And then the second time he dropped breadcrumbs. You put in the present tense, and what you know that's a convention. But what the convention is responding to is the theoretical idea that what happens in narrative happens as you're reading it. Otherwise, why would you care whether Elizabeth and Darcy got married 200 years ago? Since they're long, 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 long dead, why would that be heartwarming to you? Oh. They got married at the end. That's so nice. Given the fact that they've been in their graves now for at least 150 years. It's because because in fiction, things happen at the moment that, you know, whatever happens in fiction, it happens in the act of your reading it or attending to it or hearing it. So that's true of this poem. You would describe everything in the poem in the present tense. You would say, if you're writing about this, so then when the Blessed Damozel says, we too will seek the groves where the Lady Mary is, we can tell that she is looking forward to a religious union with the speaker when he dies or something like that. But you would say when she says. Now the question is, would you say he sees her smile? Or would you say she disappears and leaves him dark, but he remembers that he saw her smile? In other words, I saw her smile can refer to when she was alive. Not, she did communicate to me successfully. It's her eyes prayed and she smiled. And then just think how much, in a sense, how much better this is. And that's what the parentheses means, is I saw her smile. I know what that was like. So now I'm telling this story where she smiles and I'm remembering what it was like when she was on Earth and she smiled. Yeah.
Could it not?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's a sort of telescoping of those two things together. So I heard her tears, because that's not going to be he's not going to be saying, yes, when she was alive, I heard her tears. It's more like, yeah, that second parenthesis, he's crying and imagining it's her. And that would be present tense. But I think the first is, I know what that's like because I saw it. Yeah.
Maybe a dumb question, but was Rossetti particularly religious?
No. Christina was, but Dante was not. Christina was a little bit... actually, he was called Gabriel. She was a little bit scandalized by him. But they were very close as well. But Christina Rossetti became more and more religious. that probably... as I say, this poem in a way is an exercise, but it's a very powerful one. That's why it's important to see it as an exercise, not as a real person whom he's really in mourning for. He's just imagining how you could tell a story like this. And then something like, I saw her smile. That would be, it's much more heartbreaking. And I think that's the point. If it's a memory rather than justification for his confidence that she's up in heaven waiting for him. So I'm telling this story, and she smiled, end of story. But then, parentheses, yeah, I did once see her smile. Or I, when she was alive, I saw her smile. And then back to the story outside the parentheses. But soon their path was vague and distant spheres. And then she cast her arms along the golden barriers, so not in parentheses, so that's happening in the story, and laid her face between her hands and wept. And then he does the same thing. I heard her tears. Just thinking of her doing that, he now starts weeping and hears her tears at that point because they're his tears. So it's a really neatly done thing. Okay, much more time on that than I had planned for us. But let's look at Goblin Market. Had people read this before? Is this a poem you knew? Mm-hmm. What class did you do it in, or did you do it on your own?
12th grade English.
Oh, cool. All right, so what do you remember about it?
Not a lot of detail.
Okay.
I remember vaguely what happens.
Okay, so what's a very quick plot summary of Goblin Market? Anyone?
There are these two sisters.
Uh-huh, named.
Lady and Laura.
Uh-huh.
And they heard the, there's like a bunch of goblin merchants around selling fruits. Lizzie was skeptical, but Laura wanted the fruit, so she paid with a lock of her hair, got some fruit, and absolutely loved it. But then, from that day on, I think Lizzie could still hear the goblins, but Laura could not. And she starts to really crave the fruit, the same taste. So in order to help Laura, Lizzie tries to go to the goblins, tries to buy the fruits. But I think as soon as the goblin figures that she doesn't want to eat it, so they start to try to force feed fruit to her. So they keep throwing all kinds of fruit at her. In the end, so she was got all kinds of mess and pulp on her. And afterwards, she goes back to Laura and, feeds it to her. But what happens in the end?
In the end, they become mothers.
Yeah.
Okay, so, but what happens? So, first of all, it's a really vivid tale. She wrote it in a single day. So, what'd you say?
So done with these poets writing masterpieces in a day.
I know.
So rude.
Well, they had less to do during their days. They didn't have to constantly check their emails and
tuberculosis.
Yeah. Her brother illustrated it. And it was published in a book with other poems, Goblin Market and other poems illustrated by Dante Gabriel Rossetti. And got really good reviews, but didn't sell very many copies. She also kind of avoided the limelight as a poet, more and more as she got older and older. and she frequently avoided meeting other poets. Her brother knew both Tennyson and Whitman, but she avoided meeting them. She didn't want to meet either of them. So part of what is interesting about thinking of this as written in a single day is that a little bit like Child Roland to the Dark Tower came, there's an extemporizing quality to it. That is that she's making it up as she goes along, which means that the poem is more than a lot of poems. I mean, this is true of every poem, you could say. But this poem, and Child Roland, much more than most poems, is a record of its own composition. That is, what we are doing is watching her extemporize. So here's this idea of the goblins, and they are scary. And, you know, what would be great, and I think what we should try to do is actually go through the whole poem, because people don't, because it's too long, but it's a thing to do, and we can, we don't finish today, we'll do Monday. But it's not that long. You know, a lot of it reads very quickly. That's part of the pleasure of it. But it's really worth remembering, keeping in mind that it's extemporized. So let's go counterclockwise again. Why don't you do the first 30 lines, Eileen?
Sure. Morning and evening, maids heard the goblins cry. Come by our orchard fruits, come by, apples and
quinces.
Quinces, lemons and oranges, plump, unpecked cherries, melons and raspberries, bloom-down-cheeked peaches, swat-headed mulberries, wild, free-born cranberries, crabapples, dewberries, pineapples, blackberries, apricots, strawberries, all ripe together in summer weather. Morns that pass by, fair eves that fly, come by, come by. Our grapes fresh from the vine, pomegranates full and fine, dates and sharp boluses, rare pears and greenages, damsons and bilberries, taste them and try, currants and gooseberries, bright fire-like barberries, figs to fill your mouth, citrons from the south, sweet to tongue and sound to eye, come by, come by.
Great, that was quite a task, but you fulfilled it. Okay, so... imagine her just improvising this. What's she doing as she improvises?
Putting down all the fruits she can think of.
putting down all the fruits that she can think of, especially if they end with the word berries. Why? You know, why isn't it? I mean, obviously there are apples and quinces, lemons and oranges, which nothing rhymes with, famously, right? Oranges, that is... allegedly a word that has no rhymes. It actually does, but she wouldn't have known.
What?
What's the rhyme?
Wouldn't you like to know? Sporange. It's a technical word in biology. Sporange. It's a kind of spore.
Okay. Called so that's a spore. Recently developed term, okay. Since it's scientific.
Probably, yeah. Okay. But
so
that I don't know.
Most of the English history, there was nothing that rhymes.
Yes.
Is that like an extension of the word orange? It's like, no. Does it have anything to do with the fruit?
It has to do with biology, but I don't think it has any. Orange is actually, was originally narange. A narange got misheard as an orange.
Berries rhyme.
Sorry?
Berries are really easy to rhyme.
I mean, cherries and berries, that's a true rhyme. But when you say mulberries, cranberries, dewberries, blackberries, it's like saying, I'm going to rhyme 13 with 14 and rhyme it with 15 and 16. So it is cheating. But it's
better than Lear's just using the same word twice in a stanza.
In his limericks. Oh, you did not like that. Oh, well.
Even though she's not doing true rhymes with it, it does build up. The repetition is a poetic device in and of itself.
Uh-huh.
Kind of like the way you would imagine a merchant of the olden times would, you know, shout and advertise about your products.
Definitely. And the rhymes are irregular in the poem. That's a thing to notice. So oranges actually isn't rhyming with anything, unless you count quinces, which you can't really. Evening isn't rhyming. Cry is rhyming with by. Fruits isn't rhyming with anything. But it's a blizzard of objects and of products and of lines. And morning and evening, maids heard the goblins cry. So which maids? Among others. So, you know, this is a fairy tale. So the first thing you find out is that mornings and evenings, this is what maids heard.
Mm-hmm.
the goblins cry. And the goblins are, you already know, right? You don't want to buy from goblins. It's not a good idea. Did anyone think, oh, good, goblins. I wish they would come to Usedan.
I mean, are any stereotypes supposed to come to mind about goblin merchants?
What are you thinking?
Jews.
I don't think so.
Well, in a lot of the fantasy games, especially the modern ones, goblins are usually, like, stereotypically be the merchants, actually. So you would want to buy things from them, like, you know, in order there, right?
I've met quite a few nice goblins in my D&D sessions.
I think they're influenced by this poem, D&D is.
Oh, that's interesting.
But goblins are... they're a little bit fearful. Going back to Shakespeare and beyond, but for her, certainly going back to Shakespeare. Puck is a goblin in A Midsummer Night's Dream, and if you know Shakespeare, you'll know that A Midsummer Night's Dream keeps recurring in her poetry, including this poem. A Midsummer Night's Dream is somewhere behind this, but Puck is also known as Hobgoblin. They don't have your best interests in mind. That's the thing to know about goblins. So... but they're offering all these things. And that blizzard of fruit is partly... we're hearing what maids are hearing. We're hearing this list of fruits. And there's something just delightful about hearing this long list of fruits. She's delighting in writing it down and improvising it. We're delighting... in reading or hearing it. One thing to notice is apricots, strawberries, all ripe together in summer weather. So in fact, they wouldn't all be ripe together. That's, I think, part of the idea here that her audience would know a lot better than we who get our fruit from California at supermarkets know. This is also a feature of a lot of Japanese scroll painting, is that fruits that could never appear at the same time of year will appear together in these paintings. You'll have blossom and fruit. You'll have a branch with blossoms and another branch with ripe fruit, which would never happen. So that's part of the sort of mysterious fictionality of it. So these are all together. Pineapples, blackberries, apricots, strawberries, all ripe together in summer weather. Morns that pass by, fair eves that fly. What are those two lines doing there?
Showing the passage of time, that this happens every day, and it's not like the goblins just show up one day.
Okay, good. So it happens every day. It's in summer weather. But it's also maybe that among the things the goblins are offering, among the fruits that they're offering, are morns that pass by and fair eves that fly. Come by, come by. So a bunch of fruits, and then two other things for sale, morns and eves. Come by, come by. That is, have this totality of richness, of object, single things, all these different things that combine together. And all that combination of things that would ordinarily not be seen together is also in the morns that pass by and fair eaves that fly. But those are right here. The morns are not disappearing. The eaves are not, the evenings are not flying away. Just come by, come by. It's all here. Pomegranates, full and fine. Why is a pomegranate an important fruit? Yeah.
Does it have some relation to the story of Persephone?
Yes. So what happens?
Persephone eats an underworld pomegranate and gets sealed underneath, and I will say this, Hades is not the true villain that everyone makes him out to be. That Persephone was actually a little more than eager to be down in the underworld with him.
Okay, yeah. okay, good. all of these different things, sweet to tongue and sound to eye, come by, come by. What does sound to eye mean? Yeah.
Are we back to synesthesia again?
So we are, but only after we have a literal meaning. If you say,
they look good.
Yeah, they're not bruised. There aren't little wormholes in them. They're the kind of fruit that the old person at the market would not put back.
Isn't this like the time in general that pineapples were like only for the very rich?
Yeah, more 18th century, but probably still in the 19th century. So, synesthesia. So what would the synesthesia be?
I guess fruits that are so appealing to the eye that they sound good to the ear.
Okay.
Maybe thinking about like the first bite.
Okay. What about what you've just read? This long list of fruits. So the idea is it's a pleasure to read this list. It was a pleasure for her to write it. It's a pleasure for us to read it. It's just, and it's a sonic pleasure in those pseudo rhymes, in those repetitions. And that has to be the intention, because the whole point is that the goblin's cry is tempting. Yeah?
Stupid question. It's probably unrelated. Are some of these things on this list supposed to be some kind of euphemism?
So what are you thinking?
Plump unpecked cherries and bloom down cheek peaches.
Yeah. Probably you're not supposed to be quite noticing that yet, but yes. The real euphemistic fruit is figs. Whenever you see figs in a poem, it's always a euphemism or a symbol. But yes, so in that case, if you read it that way, what is it that the goblins are offering? Okay.
Or I guess more specifically in the case of our two main characters, the innocence of the little girls.
Okay. So it's the maids who hear the goblins cry. And what they're crying is the sweetness of all this fruit. What's the most famous fruit in the history of the world?
The apple.
Yes. Yeah. So the goblins offering fruit, they're tempting maids with fruit. That's what the poem is about, is they're tempting maids with fruit. And that fruit that the serpent tempts with gives Adam and Eve the knowledge of what? Yeah. But in particular, how does God know? How does the Lord know?
They
become aware that they're naked. So the way it happens in Paradise Lost is that Adam and Eve are having really... Milton was very clear that Adam and Eve were having sex before the fall, which is one of Milton's heresies. But when they eat the fruit of the Tree of Knowledge of Good and Evil, they have really hot sex for the first time that they then feel bad about afterwards. And in the same way that in her brother's poem, I don't know if you noticed this one, but the poem Nuptial Sleep on page 276. So this is post-coital. And... it's not clear how they feel quite after they've had sex when they separate. You know, it's not bad. It's not, oh my God, what have I just done? But there is a sense that it's very post-coital. So that's what happens in Paradise Lost, is Adam and Eve have hot sex for the first time, and then they're unhappy with each other, having done that. So here is the fruits, and the maids are hearing the goblins cry, and the goblins are offering all these sweet fruits, and they're saying, come by, come by. And now we get the introduction of the two main characters, Laura and Lizzie. Sophia, could you read that?
Evening by evening, among the brookside rushes, Laura bowed her head to hear, Lizzie veiled her blushes. Crouching close together in the cooling weather, with clasping arms and cautioning lips, with tingling cheeks and fingertips, lie close, Laura said, pricking up her golden head. We must not look at goblin men. We must not buy their fruits. Who knows upon what soil they fed their hungry, thirsty roots? Come by, called the goblins, hobbling down the glen. Oh, cried Lizzie, Laura, Laura, you should not peep at goblin men. Lizzie covered up her eyes, covered close, lest they should look. Laura reared her glossy head and whispered like the restless brook. Look, Lizzie, down the glen tramp little men. One has a basket, one bears a plate, one loves a golden dish of many pounds weight. How fair the vine must grow, whose grapes are so luscious. How warm the wind must blow through those fruit bushes. No, said Lizzie, no, their offers should not charm us, their evil gifts would harm us. She thrust a dimpled finger in each ear, shut eyes, and ran. Curious Laura chose to linger, wondering at each merchant man. One had a cat's face, one whisked a tail. One tramped at a rat's pace, one crawled like a snail. One like a wombat prowled obtuse and furry. One like a rattle-tumbled hurry-scurry. She heard a voice like the voices of doves, cooing all together. They sounded kind and full of loves in the pleasant weather.
Great, thank you. Okay, so two characters are introduced. What's the difference between them?
One's about to buy some fruit and one's not.
Yeah, one is, they both know that they shouldn't. So it's Laura who first says that. That is, they go there every evening. Laura bows her head to hear. Bows her head because she's trying to hear the goblins who are down, who are presumably very small and down in the grasses. Lizzie veiled her blushes. What does that mean?
Covers her face
because she's
blushing.
And why is she blushing?
Because of the sexual innuendos of the stuff that goblins.
Yeah. So if you didn't get the sexual stuff in all the fruits in the first stanza, the fact that she is veiling her blushes indicates that it's not just fruit. Or that the temptation, what's more important is the temptation than the fruit itself. So the fruit are going to be very tempting, very sweet. There's going to be a very huge erotic impact that they have. But they already know. So this is, how old would you say Laura and Lizzie are? They're maids.
Younger than 20.
Yeah. Probably just hitting puberty, or just hit puberty. So what's happening here is this is an experience of temptation, an experience of curiosity, an experience of fantasy, because they're fantasizing what the fruits are going to taste like. So that fantasy is, they're at the age of a certain kind of illicit fantasy, let's say, or fantasy that they think they're not supposed to have. So Laura said, so they're crouching close together in the cooling weather with clasping arms and cautioning lips, with tingling cheeks and fingertips. So they can feel their cheeks tingle, they can feel their fingertips tingle. lie close, Laura said. If you felt in this poem that there was some quasi lesbian relationship between Laura and Lizzie, you would not be wrong. So they're sisters, but it's not incestuous because that would be literalizing too much. What they are they're two young girls who are very, very close to each other, like Helena and Hermione in Midsummer Night's Dream, whose closeness the poem will sometimes describe as their being sisters, and sometimes describe as they're embracing each other and kissing each other. And it's not, there's no yuck factor to that. There's no sense of, wait a second, so these are lesbian sisters that's who have the hots for each other. I really don't like that. That's not what's happening in the poem. What's happening in the poem is their closeness is being refracted through various ways of describing closeness. You don't have to literalize the plot that way. Literally, they are sisters. Literally, they don't have sex with each other. So it doesn't matter. But non-literally, there is a sexual spark between them that is going to achieved. But non-literally, being sisters means that they're very close to each other. Again, it's easy to be distracted by the question, is this a poem about incest? It's the wrong question. It's not. It's a poem about two young girls who are very, very close to each other because they're sisters. But that's just a way of describing how close they are to each other, who are thinking really hard, being really haunted by the goblins of sexuality. And that sexuality is going to start, as Freud says it almost always does, as same-sex sexuality. And so since they're so close to each other, yeah, that's one way that that closeness is going to be represented. So Laura pricks up her golden head and says, we must not look at goblin men. We must not by their fruits. Who knows upon what soil they fed their hungry, thirsty roots? Want to do anything with hungry, thirsty roots? Really, you don't? Okay.
But does root have the same implication in English as in Mandarin?
What's the implication in Mandarin?
That if you say the word root most of the time, it actually just means penis.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it does. Not most of the time in English, but sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah. So here are these goblin men with their hungry, thirsty roots. It's not clear that the there is the fruits, right? In other words, if you look at it with consistent grammar, we must not look at goblin men. We must not buy their fruits. That is the goblin men's fruits. Who knows upon what soil they fed? That is the goblin men fed. So the deniable, the plausible reading of this is fed the hungry, thirsty roots of the fruits. But the syntax is suggesting that it's the goblin men who fed their own hungry, thirsty roots. So the goblin men are male sexuality, or a male attempt to take advantage of female sexuality. Their hungry, thirsty roots. Come by, call the goblins, hobbling down the glen. Oh, cried Lizzie, Laura, Laura, you should not peep at goblin men. So Laura is goblin curious, and Lizzie thinks that's wrong, but they're both tempted. That's why Lizzie blushes. Lizzie covered up her eyes, covered close lest they should look, because she would look if she didn't cover her eyes. Not lest they should see, but lest they should look. But Laura reared her glossy head and whispered like the restless brook, look, Lizzie, down the glen tramp little men. And then the description of them. Lizzie says, no, they'll harm us. But Laura chose to linger. She heard a voice like voice of doves cooing all together. They sounded kind and full of loves in the pleasant weather. So everything about this is tempting. Sam, can you do the next?
Laura stretched her gleaming neck like a thrush embedded swan, like a lily from the beck, like a moonlit poplar branch, like a vessel at the launch, when its glass of strength is gone. Backwards up the moss of wandering and trooped the goblin men with their shrill repeated cry, come by, come by. When they reached where Laura was, they stood still upon the moss, leering at each other, brother with queer brother, signaling each other, brother with sly brother. One set his basket down, one reared his plate, one began to weave a kernel of tendrils, leaves, and rough nuts brown. Men sell not such in town. One heaved the golden weight of dish of fruit to offer her. Come by, was still the cry.
Great, so Laura stays behind. She watches what they're doing. And they are coming up to her, and they're offering her their wares. Leering at each other is an interesting line. Queer is not an interesting word here. It wouldn't have meant what it now means. And one began to weave a crown of tendrils, leaves, and rough nuts brown. She is probably, I'll just say this in case you know the poem, but if not, maybe you want to. this is probably a reference to, well, ask the graduate students if they know. What poem of Wordsworth's? So.
I feel like I know what you're talking about.
Rough nuts brown.
Poem called Nutting, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So Nutting is telling a similar story. In Nutting, Wordsworth tells a story about how he goes to the woods and it's just so beautiful and amazing. He pauses in awe, but then he starts ripping all the nuts off the trees. And it's a metaphor for sexual... For going into a crude sexuality after an earlier love of nature. So she's probably, this is flickering through her mind. And they're still offering her these nuts, which, yeah, could mean what they could mean. Samantha.
Laura stared but did not stir, long but had no money. The whisk-tailed merchant bade her taste and chose the smoothest thing. The cat-faced heard, the rat-faced spoke a word with Bobham, and the snail-faced even was heard. One parrot-voiced and jolly cried pretty goblin still for pretty Polly. One whistled like a bird.
Great. So instead of saying pretty Polly, even though it's got a parrot voice, it says pretty goblin. And they're offering her these fruits in tones as smooth as honey. So even their tones are like the fruits, or sweet like the fruits that they're offering, in tones as smooth as honey. Okay, Samantha, you looked out. Ray, can you do the next one?
All right. But sweet tooth Laura spoke in haste. Good folk, I have no quiet to take or to purloin. I have no copper in my purse, I have no silver either. And all my gold is on the furs that shakes in windy weather, above the rusty heather. You have much gold upon your head, they answered all together. By Fromos with a golden curl, she clipped a lock, a precious golden lock. She dropped a tear more rare than pearl, then sunk their fruit globes fair or red, sweeter than honey from the rock, stronger than man rejoicing wine. Clearer than water flowed that juice, she never tasted such before. How should it cloy with length of use? She sucked and sucked and sucked the more fruits which that unknown orchard bore. She sucked until her lips were sore, then flung the empty rinds away, but gathered up one kernel stone, and knew not if it was it night or day as she turned home alone.
Okay, so not English teacher overreading to see this as sexual, right? Just making sure. So notice the kernel stone she picks up. That's going to come back later on in the poem. That just means the pit of a fruit, like an apricot pit. How should it cloy with length of use? That is, this is so good that it can never, I can't imagine a time when it ever would not be a fantastic pleasure. So that rhetorical question is, nevertheless, the poem is giving an implicit answer, which is what?
Oh, it will.
So this is first sexual experience. If you want to ask what sexual experience it is, that would be too literal-minded. She's obviously, it's the sexual experience of eating these fruits. If you need it to be a literal sexual experience, which I don't think you do, but if you do, it's masturbation. That is, to the extent that Rossetti is describing her own sexual life, her own sexual coming of age, her own experience of learning about sexuality, her memories of that experience. This would be just a description of coming into sexual knowledge at puberty. There doesn't have to be another person there with you. It can be this fantasy of goblins and the sweetness of that fantasy. So again, I'm not saying, yes, that's what this really is. I'm saying that that is a parallel experience, is the experience that Laura is having with the fruits here. she dropped a tear more rare than pearl, then sucked their fruit globes, fair or red, sweeter than honey from the rock, stronger than man rejoicing wine. Pearl is going to come back in the poem. And liquid pearl is something that some 19th century women poets use that term because of its because of its connotations of semen. So because that image is going to come back, I just draw your attention to it. Again, I don't want this to be crude. The whole point is the poem is not crude. It is about this intense and tempting pleasure. But it's there. So that's something that has to be spelled out as well. Okay, we will pick up from here. Keep reading. But we'll pick up from here on Monday.